Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. Today's guest is Robbie Deckard, who is a triathlon coach and professional triathlete with multiple 7.3 and middle distance podiums on his resume. He's also the founder of Freaky Fast Aero Accessories, and I've just seen you show me a nice 3D printer with some things that you're cooking up there, so we might talk about that a bit later in the interview, Robbie. Before that, though, we're also going to talk about European versus American training styles, lactate, VLA max testing, and the debate around that, aerodynamics, and plenty of practical advice for age group triathletes on improving your triathlon performance. Robbie, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Michael. Thanks a lot for having me. This has been, it was one of the first triathlon podcasts I ever started listening to, so it feels awesome being on the show.
Nice. When did you start listening?
Oh man, probably 2019, I want to say. Late 2019, probably.
Yeah.
What year did you start the podcast?
2017, but I shouldn't 17. Say that because I don't really want people to listen to those early episodes.
But, yeah. Hey man, the ones in 2019 were good, I thought.
Yeah.
So.
I think definitely a lot of the newer podcasts got to a higher quality level more quickly than I did, at least in terms of things like sound and things like that. But that being said, like there were some great guests on even in the early days, and the guests, they contribute obviously a lot to the podcast, which I'm sure you will do today as well. So let's get into my first training questions then. We've chatted a bit before, and you're coached by Luke Van Leerde. And one of the things that we talked about is that you basically have found the difference in this European style of training that you're working on now as an athlete compared to the American style, quite a contrast. So do you want to elaborate a bit on that, and then we can have a chat around it?
Yeah, definitely. So I am 31 years old. I started endurance sports 16, 17 years ago as an athlete myself. And I'm from the United States, and that's where I was born and raised. So I sort of always had an American coach. Literally American. And then I think, you know, theoretically an American coach as well, for the first 10 years of training. And I think that whole system is based around essentially Joe Friel's book, The Triathlete's Training Bible. Like, I know there are a lot of other influences and how American coaches, and not every American coach is the same. But I was just looking last night before the call just to make sure what I was saying was correct. Joe Friel's book is based around FTP, which everybody knows, the functional threshold power, more or less MLSS, critical power, LT2. And training zones, training prescription, everything is based around that. And I think that sort of dictates sort of the entire model. Whereas the European style, from what I've seen, like Luke's training, is not dictated around one single metric. It's more an entire profile of the athlete. So that's the biggest difference I've seen as an athlete, looking at the American style versus European style. And I think that's what it boils down to in the end. Have you seen a similar thing in your coaching and reading?
Yeah, I think probably. I don't disagree with what you're saying. I think the thing that I would look at slightly differently is that I don't think there is one European model. Like, I think there are vast different models used by different European coaches. And I think not knowing Luke myself, or having spoken to him, or really heard too much about his training. Actually, I know somebody that was coached by him very well. So I know a little bit about it. But I think that it's more typical of sort of a Germany plus Benelux training model. So Belgium, Netherlands, and Luxembourg, where they do work a lot on, or a lot of coaches there work with things like VLA max and looking at both of those sides of the athlete, so the VLA max and the VO2 max, and trying to fine tune those two sort of engines. But then you have so many different types of other schools of thoughts. You have the British system is maybe a little bit more, almost like I would say that it's quite polarized generally, especially the short course side of things, based on quite a bit of sort of threshold training and then some VO2 max training. Depends a bit on which modality you're talking about as well, but quite polarized, reasonable volume. Then you obviously have the international squads with with Paulo Sousa and Joel Filiol, which are probably the, and now Glenn Polonis as well, who is Belgian and probably a bit more similar to Luke. I've talked to Glenn a couple of times. So yeah, I think, his system is probably like looking more into that sort of measuring a lot of things and working on definitely taking account of VLMX and sort of things. But I guess that's the one difference that I would say, that I think that it's maybe Central European, Western European, whatever you want to call it, like Germany plus Benelux is where I would pin it more so than generally European, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And I think those methods that you just brought up, not so much the British method, specifically Luke's method, and it's not even his method, it's just how he coaches. It's sort of stemmed from Alois Mader, who's from East Germany in the 70s, I think, is when he was doing his work, if I recall correctly, from some strange little website that's out there. If you're interested in like understanding how VLMX came to be, it stems back to Alois Mader. And he sort of describes his life as a physiologist on this website. I think it's called Digital Archives. Which is some weird website that has a bunch of random things on it. But yeah, I mean, those methods sort of stem back to him and his mathematical model of human metabolism, which was him trying to figure out, okay, what's actually happening in a cell? And let's try to figure out a way to measure glycolysis and oxidative phosphorylation and then understand, you know, what is the load going into these mitochondria and what happens. And I think his later work was then centered around not so much metabolic output, more like mitochondrial synthesis after load. So I think that's actually like software like Aerotune and Inside, they prescribe training volumes for you, or at least Aerotune does. And that's what that's based off of, is Mader's mathematical model of mitochondrial biogenesis, I think.
Yeah, and I think that has to, sorry to interrupt, but I talked with Björn Kafka, I talked with both of the Aerotune founders actually, and Insight's founder, but Björn Kafka, I'm pretty sure it was who talked about that and how the premise of that model there being that the amount of aerobic work that you can sort of assimilate or adapt to is based on your VO2 max. So higher VO2 max means you can do more work, kind of, still, I think, modeling based, like you said, but definitely all very interesting work by stemming back to Mader.
Yeah. And then from Mader came Jan Ulbrecht. Mader was more like the theoretical guy, making the mathematical models. And then Jan Ulbrecht, actually, I'm not sure where Jan is from. It might
he's
be
from
Belgium.
Belgium.
Is he Belgian? Okay, yeah. He's the one who sort of applied that into training and ended up coaching advising at least hundreds of Olympic medals, I think, in swimming. And then that trickled into Luke's training. So Jan was Luke's advisor. And then that's how I sort of came to know this style of training. So I think that knowing the background is sort of interesting, and then you can see where it offshoots. Like Sebastian Weber, I think, took Mader's, you know, math to make Inside. And then, you know, there are various coaches similar to Weber, I think, like Sebastian Zeller, who you've had on your show. And actually, I listened to that podcast with Sebastian, and he ended up coaching my girlfriend for a year. So I got to know Sebastian and talking to him about training quite a bit. And it's interesting hearing how he applies his coaching to his athletes, knowing his background, which is the University of Cologne, where sort of Mader and Ulbrecht originated from, and then seeing its implementation today, which is definitely different. Previously, I think it was more centered around VLMX. Essentially, that was the golden metric. And now it's definitely more all-encompassing, I would say, in terms of not just measurements, but it looks a little more like the American style, I would say, in the way that they use work at power at VO2 max, basically, or workouts using power at VO2 max, at least with my experience with Luke as my coach, and then looking at the work of Ulbrecht, like his book, The Science of Winning, there's no use of VO2 max work in the classic sense that you and I would understand it right now. It's sort of for aerobic capacity, it's volume. and for anaerobic capacity, it's sprinting. And then to get ready for a race, you do what is called aerobic power, which is threshold work, more or less. And then to get ready for a sprinting race, like for a swimmer, you would do anaerobic power, which is repeated sprints with short rests to basically to prime the body for acidification, essentially, or the whereas the newer
wouldn't the threshold work there be, if it's Olbrecht terms, isn't that aerobic capacity that he, because aerobic power would be more like the upper end, so the VO2 max, and then threshold is what he calls aerobic capacity. So basically being able to, I might be misremembering because it's been a long time since I read his book, but I thought that was how he used those terms.
That makes sense in the way we think about it. But aerobic power, he's actually referring to increasing utilization of VO2 max.
Okay.
So when he's at aerobic capacity is VO2 max, yeah. Aerobic power is increasing utilization of VO2 max.
As an engineer, that makes my brain hurt, I have to say.
I know. Because the aerobic power is your maximal aerobic power. Yeah, it's not a capacity,
power. To be fair, that's a mistake that we do even with, or like when we talk about VO2 max as the maximum aerobic capacity, it should really be like maximum aerobic power, which we might use for the end stage of a graded exercise test. But I guess we're getting too into the weeds with semantics and terminology here, and we shouldn't let that stop us from having from discussing the actual, what it actually means, the actual application of the train.
Yeah. So to answer the question you asked me, the difference I see is utilizing that training zone, essentially, like 30-15, the classic Ronstadt 30-15 workout, or however you want to do a VO2max workout, that's essentially non-existent in the original application, I think, of that system. And now, obviously, it's extremely common to use VO2max workouts. That is sort of the biggest divergence I see from, old school modern training, if you want to call it that, to the newer implication in Germany today.
Mm. And how, what about the, how, what does that mean in practice for you as an athlete when you follow that? How often do you do things like testing, and how is that testing then translated into training prescription?
Yeah. So first, I actually disagree with not doing work at VO2 max. I think there are plenty of studies out there showing that you can increase your VO2 max. Quick question for you. Did you read the study by Ronstadt? I'm probably butchering his name, sorry. You know how I'm talking about, Bent Ronstadt. Yeah. It took a 37-year-old cyclist whose VO2 max was 74. I know these numbers because I just looked at it the other week. And using 58 weeks of block periodization, basically lit, mit, or hit, took his VO2 max from 74 to 87. Did you read that study? It was like N=1 case study.
Quite a while ago, so I don't remember any details, but I do remember that some of the blocks were pretty insane with like block periodizing the intensity. And yeah, I have read it.
Yeah. So actually, Luke has been my coach for a while. And as I've gotten older and coaching has become more of a focus, I thought, okay, I need to start trying some of these methods on myself. So I actually started coaching myself recently in between the last time you and I talked. And I'm following that study essentially, obviously with a focus on HIIT, so classic VO2 max workouts, because I do think they're effective. And that's the main disagreement I had with the sort of old school VLA max style of training. Not utilizing that training zone, I think, is a mistake. We'll see how it works.
Yeah, to some extent, and this is also my feeling around some things like, Norwegian threshold work and so on, like very threshold focused training. I think that sometimes a lot of these things, I mean, obviously everything is context dependent, but a lot of the context that we get served, at least as amateur triathletes and endurance athletes, is from professionals. And we have to think about, what do these professionals have that we don't have? Like, you're a professional, but I'm not. So when I say we, I'm talking about me and the listeners more so than you. And one of the things there is that, like, most of the professional athletes, they have a natural, first of all, they've been training for a long time, lots of volume over many years, which will raise VO2 max, but there also is a natural propensity to increase VO2 max from training in general. So, and there has probably over the years been enough HIIT stimulus that they've gotten pretty close to their VO2 max ceiling. And that's not to say that it can't improve further potentially, but the point being there that when, I think in my opinion, when people do like a lot of threshold training and focus on that and thinking that you don't need VO2 max training, that's very true in a certain context when you already are pretty close to your genetic potential for VO2 max. And that is probably not the case for a lot of people listening. So yeah, that's a long-winded way of saying that, yeah, I think that you're absolutely right that for the majority of people, like working on VO2 max is very important.
And even what's interesting is looking at VO2 max compared to power at VO2 max, because if you reach a VO2 max of 80, you know, an elite level VO2 max, you can still, and it's shown in Ronstadt's study, I believe, increase your power at VO2 max, or more or less your 5-minute power. So I find that quite interesting, because at the end of the day, your VO2 max doesn't matter on race day. Power, I mean, speed is what matters, and power, you know, determines your speed. So I think it is, even if you're not increasing your actual measurement of VO2 max in the lab, I think working on increasing that 5-minute power as an elite is still valuable. And then that looks more into power duration curve, which may be more valuable than looking at the lab metrics.
So if we come back to sort of the initial phrasing of the question, which was a bit provocative with the European versus American, but what would you say are the sort of, in your opinion, how did each of these models work for you? And what is, knowing what you know now, what would you change potentially with each of these models?
Yeah, I think every model can work. I mean, the American method, there's nothing wrong with it. Like, it works for plenty of people. For me, it worked because I was new to the sport and I trained with it for 10 years and improved, you know, 10 years in a row. And maybe I would have kept improving for another 5 or 6 years up to this point using that model. But looking back, what would I change? I think because using FTP-based models is so isolated on FTP, you do miss out on gains in other places on the power duration curve. Essentially, when you're focused in on that moderate intensity, you tend to get good at that. But knowing what I know today, I probably would have focused more on high volume of VZ training and more VO2 max work at a young age. Because I do think eventually everyone's VO2 max is limited by genetics. But I think working on, now I'm going to say aerobic capacity, aerobic maximal aerobic power early on at a young age is probably the better way to go, because that ends up being your ceiling as an athlete. So that's the biggest thing I would change, is just going easier to do more volume and then a little more high intensity training, because there was a lot of threshold training early on, which I think can blunt your progress overall in the long term. It's like focusing on that race specific type work, which is what the FTP model is centered around, which it should be in the end, because that's your race pace as an endurance athlete, you know, more or less, depending on what distance you're doing. But yeah, that's the biggest thing I would change for my own training. And anytime I have a younger athlete that I work with now, I sort of explain that, like, look, you don't need to only do VO2 max work. But remember, if you're in it for the long run and you want to be racing professionally, you need a certain ceiling. So it's sort of like focus on the most important things first, which is 5-minute power or 1 mile speed on the track or 500 yards or meters in the pool. And if you can get that to a good level, then it's relatively easy to bring a threshold up closer to that level. But once you're getting threshold close to VO2 max, it's a lot harder to compete at the elite level, I think. I'd rather have a more inefficient, higher powered athlete, at least at a younger age, than a super efficient, you know, 87% utilization of VO2 max athlete at age 18, because it's probably harder to develop that athlete any further on the VO2 max side.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. And arguably, especially for younger athletes, it's just a bit easier to sustain that sort of more polarized training, focusing on easy volume and then some key high intensity workouts, rather than, the problem with threshold training is that you kind of, like, the stimulus, to have a progressive overload, you kind of almost need to keep doing more and more of it in a way. So it's quite easy to just end up having too much of it tricky to find a balance there. I think I'm with you there with from a long-term athlete development perspective, focusing much more on the a polarized model in the early years especially, and that basically forms the large base of what your performance ceiling eventually is going to be, and then you can layer on threshold training, and that's going to just basically be not the icing on the cake necessarily, but a smaller, still important part of your of ultimately optimizing your performance.
Yeah, and I think using an approach like that is better long term, because you can work on building more durability. In my mind, I was just reading an article the other day about durability and what separates junior athletes and U23 athletes to senior athletes as professional cyclists. And there was no difference between those three categories in any duration under 60 seconds. So the high intensity power was there, but what did separate the seniors from the juniors was durability, or their 12 minute to 30 minute power after already doing some work in the lab. And I mean, what increases durability? Nobody knows exactly. You know what I mean? It's not,
Just volume.
Yeah, volume. Yeah, pretty much. I think that's the consensus.
I think people try to sell, some people try to sell you the like do intervals at the end of the workout. I don't believe in any of that. It's just volume over time.
I think it's volume. And focusing on that easy volume is the best, or going easy enough to do volume is the key to doing volume, essentially. So I do like that approach for a younger athlete.
Yeah. Big thanks to our sponsor, Precision Fuel and Hydration. If you have ever struggled with your fueling and hydration strategy, Precision make it simple with products that are designed around real-world athletic needs and applications and backed by science. They do amazing gels like the PF30 and PF90, plus the caffeinated version of the PF30 for an extra kick. They also have the Flow Gel that holds 300 grams of carbohydrates. You can have a big amount of carbs in just one bottle without having to mix various gels into water. And on the hydration side, they offer drink mixes and multi-strength electrolytes tailored to how much sodium you lose in your sweat, and sodium capsules for a quick and easy top-up of sodium. Best of all, they have a free fuel and hydration planner that you can use to get a personalized strategy tailored to your event, your sweat profile, and more. So check it all out at precisionfuelhydration.com. And as a TTS listener, you get 15% off your first order with the code TTS2026. So can you tell us about, is there anything else between your working with American coaches and that model and working with Luke? Have you had any other influences in your own training over the years that might be worth talking about as well?
Yeah, I mean, of course, there's hundreds of influences, just things you read, talking to athletes. I mean, I can think of probably 10 different sort of stupid training methods I did over the year, you know, or it's like you read something or talk to somebody.
Talk about some of them that you committed to a little bit more, that you actually tried somewhat properly.
Yeah, two of them were pretty similar, so I'll lump them together. I used to live in Boulder, Colorado, where everybody is a professional triathlete or ex-world champion or Olympic medalist. And I won't name the coaches, but I had two coaches in that time period who were both world champions themselves, like top, top level athletes, one, you know, in long distance, one in short distance. And it turns out that's not a prerequisite to being a good coach. And if you are a naturally gifted athlete, gifted enough to be world champion, and don't understand the training, it's very easy to overtrain athletes. So I sort of fully committed to doing the training program of these two coaches at two different times, but it turns out they were the same training program, which was just a lot of moderate intensity all the time. Because if you have a huge VO2 max, like I'm sure they did as in their prime, you want to increase the utilization. And I don't have a big VO2 max, and there was no testing to determine, okay, what are your strengths and weaknesses? You know, no testing at all. It was just do a lot of threshold work, essentially. So it was just doubling down on threshold 5 days a week and then just trying to get out of bed on the other 2 days. And it does work, obviously. You know, anytime you train hard, if you stress your body, it will adapt. So it's going to work for a little bit. But I got pretty cooked from those methods. It was heart rate based. So we would set a heart rate that was the threshold heart rate, you know, this magic heart rate, about 165 on the bike for me and probably 170 on the run. And obviously, as you get more overtrained, your heart rate comes down and it gets harder and harder to hit that heart rate. But that's what I was shooting for the whole time. So you end up pushing harder and harder. And that was by far the most overtrained I've been in my life. But it's amazing, the mind. Like, if you believe something is going to work, because for whatever reason you believe in it, like, you can push yourself into very heavy overtraining, which I did. I did during that time. So that's one method that, you know, I tried out, but obviously didn't work. But as a 19-year-old, you know, you don't know anything about training, so you just follow what your coach gives you. That was probably the worst training method I ever tried, which is setting a threshold heart rate and then trying to hit it for 6 months straight, you know, 5 days a week, two sessions a day.
To be honest, I can't really think up anything much worse.
Yeah, no, that was it. I remember I was running with Rudy Von Berg, who's obviously a good long distance athlete, better than I am, more naturally talented. He had more training years in his legs than I did and going into college. And we were training together under the same coach. So he lasted a little longer than I did with his training, just because he had more durability at the time. And we were running on a famous road, Magnolia Road in Boulder, doing a long run at too fast of a pace. And I just had to stop and sit down on a rock. I just sat on a rock for 20 minutes once I reached peak overtraining, and then walked the 4 miles back to the car. And that was when I realized that training method was not working anymore.
Yeah. Well, running on Magnolia Road with Rudy Von Berg, that brings me to a slightly different but interesting question that I'm fascinated by, which is training environment. So have you always been training in Boulder? The follow-up to that, I guess, then is, what do you think is the impact of not the training itself, but the training environment, including facilities and what, but also training partners, those sorts of things, on your ability to improve?
Yeah, I think it has a massive effect on performance. Environment does, for sure. You just touched on facilities. I don't think facilities matter that much. If you have a pool to swim in, that's good enough. As long as the roads are safe enough to ride on and you can get the volume in, that's fine. I think what's way more important is the emotional morale of the group. I'm from a place that has harsh winters. Originally, that's where I lived the first 18 years of my life. And it's tough to get out the door when the weather's really crappy, but if you're motivated, it's not tough. So even the weather is not so important compared to who you're with. But let's see, I'm diverging now into weather. Training environment is super important. And looking at a country like Norway, for example, which has 5.5 million people or 6 million people or something like that, that's the size of Phoenix, which is the city closest to me. It's amazing how many top endurance athletes Norway has, considering how small they are. And I think that is environmental. It does come down to training, for sure, which you could say is a result of the environment, because people are interested in sports science and they do good research and then apply good research to athletes who are motivated. And they're motivated because of the environment, so you get good results. But there's one good athlete from Phoenix I can think of, like Jim Walmsley, you know, and he doesn't live here anymore. So why is it that Phoenix has one top level athlete and Norway has hundreds? I think it comes down to environment completely. I mean, Norway doesn't have particularly good weather for training half the year. I don't know. I've never been there in the winter, but it doesn't look very nice from social media. And I think that's completely environmental. And that's created by being around positive people who share a common goal and are willing to learn from each other. And fail along the way. Obviously, you know, you don't go straight from nothing to success simply because you're positive and everybody around you is positive. But, you know, being able to fail and try things along the way is a big part of environment. So being in Boulder, it's definitely a good environment for training. Like, the physical environment is amazing. The Rocky Mountains are awesome for training. You have altitude. There are great pools, great roads for riding, great dirt for running on. The tracks are free, which I don't know how it is where you live, but in a lot of the US, you're not allowed to run on tracks, for like school tracks for some reason. But in Boulder, all the tracks, for the most part, are free. You can just go run on them any time of day. So that helps shape the environment, the actual environment. But, you know, there's so many athletes there that it makes it easy to get out the door. You know, when you look out the door and see, oh, there's Rudy riding out the road. Like, you know, obviously I'm going to go for a ride. So I think, to generally answer your question, environment plays a huge role in performance.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. And I think that's an argument that I've made quite a few times, probably on this podcast as well, that with Norway as an example, that I think it's a lot more about the culture and the environment rather than the, like, the training methods themselves. And it's maybe a topic for a different discussion, but I find that fascinating. And when I said facilities, I think that one of the biggest one is, it's not facilities per se, it's access to good roads to ride on, good safe roads, being able to get out the door and ride outdoors and it being safe. I think if you have like some variety in the riding, it doesn't have to be, I don't think that you have to have access to mountains or any particular type of riding per se, but having some variety just to get a bit of variation in the sort the technical skills that you're also learning, that helps for sure. Not to say that's definitely necessary. You have so many great Dutch cyclists from a completely flat country where you can ride on straight cycle paths for kilometers and kilometers on end, and they do work up amazing cycling skills anyway. Well, at least when they start to go and do races in different places and do training camps in different places. So it's not the be all end all. But yeah, I think from a triathlete perspective, cycling infrastructure is one of the, and cycling safety is probably the one that I would see as the most important one. But obviously, you do need to have a pool of some sort. That's a must.
Yeah, cycling safety, and I think just cultural environment as well. I mean, in the U.S., endurance sports are not super popular. And it's hard. I mean, it goes back to what you were saying about cycling safety. It's hard to ride your bike places, and it's not. That's because it's not part of the culture. We didn't design our cities around riding bikes. You know, Amsterdam was designed to ride your bike around, whereas Phoenix, you would be hit by a car within 10 minutes if you rode your bike, you know, for training in downtown Phoenix. So I think, yeah, the culture of your country or city can be extremely important in determining, you know, your success as an athlete, or even if you become an athlete to begin with.
Yeah, no, 100%. I did have this discussion quite recently that, but because I think the US does have a huge endurance, like they have great endurance athletes in swimming, obviously, like the dominant country together with Australia, and running as well, like great. Obviously, the East Africans are the most dominant force there, but the US are still very good in distance running, really across the different distances generally, and have been for quite a long time. But cycling is where the Europeans are dominating more so, and in triathlon as well, because the bike is such a huge part of triathlon. So I think that it comes down to that cycling culture that in Europe you bike everywhere. So it's just an extension of your body almost, and you go places with the bike, not just for training. And the roads are a bit different. Like you have to ride on smaller roads, do more technical practice, and not ride on big straight roads so much. I'm not familiar with all the parts of the US, obviously, but generalizing a bit, I think that's a somewhat accurate statement, at least.
Yeah, I think I'm a decent bike handler, and I think most of that came from one, following Rudy in college. That was formative because he's pretty good on the bike, but also just commuting to class. I mean, in college, I rode my bike to class every single day, and that's huge for your bike skills. Like, so if I could increase my bike skills in 4 years, it's amazing what you probably could do if you grew up on a bike, commuting everywhere. Like you said, it's an extension of your body at that point. If you've been riding to school since you were four, I mean, it's natural to be good at cycling.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's switch gears a little bit. And so if we talked about all these different training methods that you've tried and you used in yourself, but what about, how do you coach athletes as a coach? What would you say are the core tenets of your coaching and the training principles that you believe in?
It sort of comes back to what we touched on before. How would I change my training at a young age. And that's focusing more on capacity. So I do like working with young athletes because they tend to be the most excited about training. My philosophy is centered around first building capacity or maximal aerobic power. It's ingrained in my mind. I'll never stop saying capacity. But yeah, it comes back to seeing your strengths and weaknesses. If your goal is to race elite, which a lot of athletes who I coach, their goal is to, you know, be at that level, essentially, even if they don't want to race professionally, it's to be very good. But first understand where the athlete's at and how far is their maximal aerobic power from where it needs to be. And then developing that and then working on utilization along the way. So maybe that's too specific of an answer to that question. I guess generally
that's a good starting point for the training at and the physiology side of things, which is obviously very important in triathlon. Let me follow up on that then. So if you have somebody who is, I don't know, 18, 19, 20 years old, and they have that goal to basically be the best athlete they can be, potentially race professionally, maybe as a long distance or middle and long distance triathlete. Do you have any sort of benchmarks for understanding, okay, are they already pretty close to where they need to be from that maximum aerobic power level, or how far do you have to go? Are you looking at 5 minute power? What are the metrics or the tests that you're doing to assess that?
Yeah, the three that are very easy, especially if you're working with an athlete who is recently in high school, are 500 yard TT in the pool, because that's the distance that you swim in high school and races. So if you swim in high school, you probably swim the 500 some. And if you're an endurance athlete, you probably swim a lot. So looking at 500 time on the bike, 5 minute power, like you said, and then on the run, 1 mile, because that's what you run in high school. So you're getting a lot of testing. So to say in high school, you know, sometimes you have a track meet or swim meet, you know, twice a week. So it's like you get to do a 5 minute all out test twice a week for 3 months straight in the season. So off the bat, most people have those metrics, which are super helpful to have. And then on top of that, what I would like to do is, if they have lactate available, do a lactate step test. So automatically you have on the bike metabolic and power duration curve. So you have LC1 and LC2, and now you can relate them to the 5 minute power. With those three numbers, I think you can build a really solid training plan. Same on the run. If you have 1 mile time and LC1 and LC2, you can see a lot about the athlete, even without testing VLA max. If LC2 is very slow relative to 5 minute power and lactate is through the roof after 1 mile all out, you can assume the VLA max is on the higher side without even testing it. And then same on the swim. It's amazing how glycolytic people tend to be on the swim. And I think that's because as a younger athlete, you focus on sprints. People are generally at age 16, better at the 100 than they are the 1500. So typically I'll see, you know, the VLA will be higher in a swimming type athlete because you do gym work as well. But if you can have those three metrics, which is what I try to get off the bat, I think you can build a completely robust training plan, and you have something that you can track over time, you know, for the next decade.
Yeah. What do you, if you take two athletes that are on the different ends of the spectrum, so one that has a very large difference between their top end and their LT1 and LT2, and one where LT1 and LT2 are pushing up against their top end, how does that influence the type of training that you're doing?
Yeah, I think you won't be surprised with the answer. But if you have a huge difference between VO2 max or 5 minute power or speed and LT1 and LT2, then it's completely acceptable and necessary to work on some threshold work. And even if you're doing VO2 max work, you can structure your workouts. A workout I like is 40 seconds at 5 minute power or pace, and then 1 minute around threshold. So that's a less high intensity or less glycolytic way to achieve a similar result, which is working on VO2 max. So obviously working more on the middle or moderate intensity training. If you have a huge separation, you don't want too big of a separation. Earlier I said you want to work on that 5 minute power a lot, but at a certain point you do need to race. You know, it's nice to work on your capacity for 6 or 7 years or your VO2 max, but you are racing along the way. So I don't want an athlete to be blowing up every single race, you know, because they're super glycolytic, but their 5-minute power is great. So there's an acceptable range, I feel like, especially with a younger athlete, it doesn't matter as much as when you're getting older and now you're racing professionally. You know, you need to perform. So with a younger athlete, yeah, I'm not too tied to your threshold needs to be within 79 and 83% of your 5-minute power. It's more, is it in the range of allowing you to perform at your race, which is usually a sprint triathlon? And if it is, then work on the MAP or maximal aerobic power.
I know you used that as an example that it's not about it, but when you say when you talk about the measure like threshold as a percentage of VO2 max, are you talking about the power at LT2 compared to the 5-minute power then on the bike as your proxy for VO2 max, or because you're not doing actual metabolic cart testing there, so you're not talking about the actual oxygen uptake, but the power or the pace, let's say.
Yeah, it depends on what type of testing the athlete's doing. I like the lactate step test followed by 5-minute allowed. I'll also use Aerotune or Inside or Sentiero. I don't know if you've ever heard of Sentiero. I think it's Robert. Yeah, it's the same thing. It's the exact same thing, but it's for free. Yeah, check it out. It's called Sentiero, and I think it's Robert Gorg. No, it's not Robert Gorgas. It's an old Bora Hansgrohe guy. I forget his name, but it's for free online. But yeah, so it depends. The exact percentage depends on how you're doing the testing. But yeah, so that's it depends is the answer.
How can an age grouper apply the same principles? And if so, what would you? Can we give some practical examples of how to profile yourself as an age grouper if you have a lactate step test and you have a 5-minute all out test? How do you know? Because you don't, you're an age grouper that don't coach others. You only have your own numbers. How do you know where you are on that spectrum of being close LT2, being close to VO2 max, or being far from it?
Yeah, if for me, my 5-minute power usually sits around 400 watts. So I find if I can get my LT2, and by LT2 I mean not like 4 millimole, like actual LT2. Up to 300 watts, which is 75%, that's a good utilization. So I think this is maybe what you were getting at earlier, like 80% in the lab. Yeah. So it will be lower, that's a lower percentage.
75%, isn't it?
75, what did I just say? Yeah, 75%. Yeah. So I find 75% is a pretty good utilization using the method that I use, which is the LT1, LT2, and 5-minute power. So if you have access to a lactate meter and a power meter, do the test, 5-minute steps. I increase 20 watts every step. It depends on what you expect your threshold power to be. And you can change your steps going up to get more granular as you get closer to threshold. So if you want to start with 40 watt steps and then move to 20 watt steps as you get closer to the threshold, that's fine. It doesn't matter exactly the protocol. But yeah, once you're seeing 50% and 75%, I think that's like a pretty standard profile for an endurance athlete. LT1, LT2, 5-minute power. That's what I meant. 50, 75, 100%. I think that's like a good middle range. You can go either way from there. You can work on 5-minute power or you can work on 1-hour power. Once you start seeing numbers, you know, 5, 6% higher than that, then I find you have very good utilization and you're ready for middle to long distance. And honestly, I don't see much difference in profiles in terms of percentages in an athlete who's ready for a long distance and a middle distance. I think then the difference comes down to where you're emphasizing your training. For a long distance, obviously it's more LT1 type work and you will have a greater utilization. But I think the biggest gains from my experience come from more economy at race pace. Are you still there?
Yep. Yeah, still here.
Oh, sorry, the video froze. I find the biggest gains leading into a full distance come from more economy at race pace. So in the final 3 to 4 weeks before the race, you're worried less about what's my percent utilization and more how efficient am I at the pace that I need to be in the race.
Yeah. And if you are in that middle range, and let's say you're in more of a base phase, so you're not close to racing anytime soon, how would you then think about whether to go up and work on that top end or work on utilization?
For me, then it's not so much about the numbers, and that's experience. Listening to the athlete's feedback during workouts. I mean, I'm big on the science, and that's sort of what I'm most, or what I have been most interested in learning about over the years. But I think in that situation, it comes down to experience as a coach or an athlete, understanding the feelings in your own body. And then as a coach, understanding how to interpret those feelings, or how an athlete describes how they felt during a 30-30 workout or a 30-15 workout. You can do the same workout as the same athlete and have very different feelings. And I've experienced this many times in my life doing 30-15s. Sometimes the power feels pretty easy and you're able to push hard the whole workout. Sometimes it's pretty hard to hit the power, but you're still able to complete the workout and it's a good workout. But there's a feeling there. And it's not expressed in numbers. It's just how it's not just how easy is the workout to complete. It's how quickly could you accelerate in that first 2 or 3 seconds. And that's probably not so much resulting from VO2 max, but it's not even glycolytic power. Maybe that's more PCR. But you can feel, you know, how easy is it to push the power in those first few seconds? And those types of feedback are important in determining, for me as a coach, how to progress the workouts from there. Because I think it's very easy to go down a path where if it feels hard to do a workout like that and it's not due to excessive fatigue, I think it's important to pump the brakes a bit and maybe work a little more on sprint type training to get power feeling easier before moving into to a workout like the 40-60 that I described earlier. I think it's easy to overdo it if you ignore those feelings or don't know how to interpret the feeling of power not feeling pretty easy to generate.
Yeah. I want to ask you about how you structure three different types of sessions, and so structure, but also then execution advice. So endurance work and threshold work and VO2 max work. You can feel free to use whichever, well, bike or run as the modality, I think, is easier than swim. So use whichever one you want. But how do you prescribe, or do you have particularities around how you prescribe each of these three types of training and advice for executing these sessions well?
More like how I prescribe them in power or throughout the day?
So when an athlete sees that, okay, I have an endurance ride today, what do they see in training peaks? Is it a power target? Is it an RPE target?
Okay.
Is it power rate? And what are the other cues or instructions that they need to follow?
Yeah, for swimming, it will be pace based. So ideally, the athlete will know LT1 and LT2. And a 500 if they're in a pool, a yards pool, or 400 if they're in meters pool. So it'll be pace-based, based off usually the metabolic data. So like for a zone 1, zone 2 swim, it's definitely under LT1. And then the speed depends on the rep distance. So if it's 20 by 100 zone 2, it'll be slightly quicker in terms of pace than if it was, you know, 5 by 500 zone 2. And that's something I picked up from Luke. I was always interested in my training zones. He would give me the pace depended on the distance of the rep, which I agree with. I think you should speed up a little bit the shorter the rep is. But also, I disagree with it in the sense that there is more glycolytic activity if you're swimming faster, even if the rep is shorter and your lactate concentration is the same, which is why he was giving zones like that. It was based off of lactate concentration at the end of the rep. But anyway, that's going into the weeds. So I'll use pace for the swim. And then, as you know, early on working with an athlete, you need to be more communicative of how is this supposed to feel. If an athlete's tired, you don't want them trying to hit the pace that you gave, that they set on a fresh day. So it's important, especially early on, to understand the language. You know, here's the pace. More importantly, here's how it should feel, more or less. On bike power, I will look at the heart rate as, you know, in the file, but the workouts are prescribed. With power, I love power. I love my power meter. I tend to stare at it as an athlete myself, and I love seeing metabolic data paired to power, which is easy to do on the bike. So in my head, I'm prescribing workouts in carbohydrate and fat combustion. But that's in training peaks, that looks like power for an athlete. And then for the run, it depends on the athlete on the run and their fitness level and the workout. I think heart rate is actually pretty valuable on the run to use, especially if you're going like to an altitude camp or it's hot outside. I find heat has a big influence on heart rate on the run, relatively compared to the bike. I don't know if you find the same thing, but it's easier to go 10 beats too high on the run if it's hot outside than it is on the bike. But yeah, so the run, it depends on the workout. If it's a VO2 max workout on an uphill, then it's RPE, just old school RPE, which I think is studies show is can be the most effective way to perform like a high intensity workout, using an RPE anchor, you know, start at 16 to 17 out of 20 and then at 18 out of 20, compared to trying to hit a heart rate, obviously, because there's a lag with heart rate.
And when it comes to the powers, paces that you prescribe for endurance work, do you tend to, is that, if we look at a classic, like coming back to the triathlete's training bible, your endurance rides are 55 to 75% of FTP. I guess that's what he said. Like he uses the whole zone two. Do you have a more specific version, or like do you tend to sit on the lower end or the upper end or in the middle, or just a pretty wide range of powers and then the athlete decides based on how they feel on the day?
I don't use percentages as a coach, like not percentages of 5 minute power, not percentage of threshold, which is one pet peeve I have with Training Peaks is when you design a workout, and this is why I don't design workouts on Training Peaks. It's based off FTP. Like you have the athlete's FTP input. And so if you make a workout, sorry, go ahead.
I meant just more in terms of, not in terms of what percentage you use, but whether the endurance work is a bit easier or a bit harder middle range, regardless of whether it's absolute values or percentages.
Yeah, for sure on the easier side. I've had this conversation probably 5 times in the last month with people talking about cycling power. If you do a metabolic test, either go to the lab or do Aerotune or Insight or whatever it is, if you can get some sort of pretty accurate carbohydrate and fat oxidation data and tie it to power output, it's amazing how much fat you can burn if you're pretty fat, or not pretty fat, pretty fit. You can be fat and fit at the same time. But if you're pretty fit, how much fat you can burn at a very easy pace. And that's sort of what I'm after on the endurance rides, unless we're after something specific, like to lower VLA max. Going out and riding 150 watts is not useless, in my opinion. You can burn 55 grams of fat, which is quite a bit at 150 watts, or 50 grams of fat, and only 40 grams of carbs, more or less, which I think is great. You can go ride 5 hours, you can eat 40 grams of carbs, no problem, and you've burned 3,000 calories in a workout. So I tend to move towards the easier end of the zone, especially for endurance work, because I think you get a large percentage of the adaptations going easy that you would going slightly harder with way less room for overdoing it.
Then threshold work, what does that look like? How do you prescribe it? What are the cues that you'd use there? How does it compare maybe to the very classic types of threshold training that people might associate with threshold training from something like the Triathlete's Training Bible?
Yeah, the method I've found most effective for me and my athletes is using not a set lactate concentration. So first, I think using lactate during threshold work is very helpful, not only in executing the individual session, but learning about your body. Because once you sort of see how different things have an influence on lactate, I think you can pace sessions naturally much better. It depends on the athlete. If they're super glycolytic and very powerful, I think using 3.5 millimole as an anchor is safe. They might, 99% of the time, the athlete is going to say it felt too easy. I wasn't trying that hard. But over 6 weeks, 3.5 will get harder and harder, or faster and faster. So I do like to use lactate during threshold sessions. One, because it improves the execution of that individual session. But then, like I said, it teaches the athlete a lot. And as a coach, it teaches me how their body is responding to the training. If you have an athlete doing 270 watts at 3.5 and they say it feels easy, 6 weeks later, you see at 3.5, they're doing 290 watts and they're pushing pretty hard. You can see how the training is going, which is important. Like that's like lab testing, it's hidden lab testing. even just using those spot lactate samples.
And what would your, how much work would you tend to prescribe for threshold training? How long intervals, work to rest ratios? Where do you stand on those things?
I don't think it's too set. I've tried everything, like in terms of work to rest ratios. I mean, you can go out and do 5 by a mile on the track with 60 seconds rest, enough time to check your lactate and move on. Or you can insert 5 by 5 minutes around threshold pace in a long run. The effect is different, but it depends on the effect that you want, is my answer. So if you're preparing for an Olympic distance, I think it's better to do a workout more like the 5 by mile that I suggested, because you can go a little faster on the track. If you're preparing for an Ironman, I think it's fine to add in, 4 by 8 minutes tempo to threshold. You don't have to be exactly at threshold in the middle of a long run. And maybe this comes back to durability, which I can't tell you exactly why it's working that way, but I do think performing intervals under some sort of load and performing intervals with large breaks in between. You might think it's an easier workout if you have bigger gaps in between your intervals, but it can be harder depending on how big those gaps are. If it's 30 minutes and you have 5 intervals, it can be harder to do those intervals, than doing the same work with 2 minutes rest. So it depends on what the athlete's preparing for. There's no set way to do threshold intervals in my mind. And you can even incorporate torque on the bike, which I am a proponent of. I know some people say it works, some people say it doesn't work. The studies go both ways. I think using low cadence work is super effective to work on threshold without having to bump up right against threshold in terms of intensity or power.
Yeah. I was thinking about it earlier today that probably in the next few weeks, I'm going to do maybe with Jack an episode on things that we do as coaches that the science doesn't sort of support. And I would say that work goes right in on my list there for sure. I'm also
for sure a believer.
Coming back to the threshold work though, if somebody has a bike threshold of 300 watts, let's say, do you think it matters if they do something like, 30 minutes of work right at 300 watts, or they maybe do 45 minutes of work at 285, 290 watts, or they do an hour of work at 275 watts? Like basically that sort of area between LT1 and LT2, does it really matter where you are, or is it more about accumulating work in that zone?
Generally, I don't think it matters that much, because in my mind, the effect you're after is decreasing VLA max or increasing utilization of VO2 max. So I think a 20 watt difference is not going to matter too much. If you go up a hill, all of a sudden your torque increases and probably your muscle fiber recruitment changes. So it's like splitting hairs in my mind, trying to hit 300 versus 290. Too big a difference in power, and it's probably a different stimulus. But the first thing you want to say is, what is the goal of the session? And if it's to increase utilization of VO2 max, then I think doing anything relatively close to threshold is fine. Going over threshold, I think, is where now you're doing something, I don't want to say wrong, but that's where things change. I think within 10% of threshold underneath is fine. 5% over can be a completely different workout and then affect your training, quite a bit over the next few days. So no, I don't think it's super important to be perfectly at threshold and be measuring lactate and be worried if your lactate goes from 2.5 or whatever, 2 point, depends on the athlete, but 2.3 to 2.5. I got to bump. If you go from 3 to 4.4, now there's a difference, especially if you're not so glycolytic. But to answer the question, no, I don't think there's a huge need to be like extremely precise on threshold work.
And the final question on threshold, how do you have any sort of benchmarks or rules of thumb for how much total work you're shooting for? If we have, let's say that this is now a session that is dedicated to increasing your threshold or your utilization. So this is the main focus. It's not a long ride with threshold work or a long run with threshold work. It's a threshold session. How much work would you tend to want to get in?
I mean, it depends on the training that's happened in the 2 weeks before and then where the race is or what's coming up after that workout. So it depends on that. But I think you can do it two ways. I think you can introduce threshold work and spices throughout the week, and that's less stressful per session, but you can get in the same amount of time over the week. Or you can have two threshold sessions in a week where you get up to an hour, you know, maybe even 70 minutes, depending on how close to threshold you're actually going in a single workout. So it depends on what you've done previously. If you're fatigued, I wouldn't do 70 minutes of threshold unless there's a reason. If you have a race coming up, then I think it's probably better to do those harder workouts where it's more condensed into a single workout. So it depends. Yeah, it depends. Again, yeah, I don't think there's the best way to do it.
And finally, then VO2 max sessions, your thoughts on structuring them?
Yeah, first, I look at the studies on VO2 max. Second, I think that seems insane. Some of these protocols that they're using, like even doing the classic 30-15s, doing 13 reps of that for three rounds is pretty freaking hard. Like if you go out and do that at your 5 minute power, like that's a super hard workout. So I tend to go on the lower side, and then as the athlete adapts, build onto that. So that depends on the athlete feedback. You can easily smash yourself with VO2 max work, I find. So I would prefer to progress a workout one or two extra times than go for it on the first round and then the athlete gets sick or too tired to do the workout on the third session. That's more of a coaching as an art thing for me than science, because some of the protocols in science are a little too extreme in my mind. Like the N equals one study we were talking about. Like I'm actually trying to do that myself. I just want to see, you know what I mean? Like at this point, it's an experiment and I want to see how it works. So like I'm building up to five VO2 max sessions per week. I have a bit of a run injury, not related to doing five VO2 max sessions per week. So it's all on the bike right now and the swim. But yeah, I think that's an extreme way to do it. And honestly, if you're not with an athlete in person, doing something extreme like that is a recipe for overdoing it.
It was a few weeks ago when I had Colin Moore on the show. He was quite eloquent in how he said that, well, like, how in the scientific study you try to control everything, right? So this was about the rests between intervals and why they are typically specified as, well, very often 1-to-1 in terms of VO2 max studies, although sometimes that varies. But and like looking at, well, okay, that's just because they need to control everything, but as long as you get in the work throughout the ride, like you talked about with the threshold, then it probably doesn't matter. And I think that same thing applies with to some extent with the amount of work that you're doing, and why just because the studies do three rounds of 13 times 30-15s, it doesn't mean that you need to do it. And yeah, you do. For some people, need to build up to that. That being said, I've done that workout like probably dozens of times. The full,
really, like 13, the full one.
Yeah, okay. It's hard, but it's not like the hardest workout that I ever do. I have to say, maybe I tend to anchor the power like sort of like slightly conservative 6 minute power, not the 6 minute power or 5 minute power that I can maybe do on my best day. But yeah. I think it's quite doable. But if you're very glycolytic, I would be much more careful with that though. Like I think that when you have a higher utilization compared to glycolytic power, then it's easier to do those sorts of sessions and not be wrecked by them and vice versa.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I've been using actually 4 minute power. The power I'm using for my 5 minute power is actually a 4 minute power. So maybe that's why it's so hard for me. But like 92% of 4 minute power. So, which I think comes fairly close to 5 minute power. But
yeah. And do you do then the rests are 50% of the intervals? So if you do, let's say if you do 400 watts, then it's 200 watts for the 15 seconds. So not coasting, but actually pedaling.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's honestly easier to do it that way. Using full rest, one, you have to accelerate more, which I find it's like taxes you throughout the workout. And then two, you're probably burning some lactate off.
Yeah, I think it becomes a very glycolytic workout, and that's one of the myths. But that's also why I tend to be a little bit conservative with the ons, because I really want, especially when prescribing it to other athletes, I really wanted to be able to pedal and keep that sort of somewhat on recoveries rather than just resting. And so I'd rather dial down a bit, 10, 20 watts lower in the 30 seconds, but keep like be quite strict with the 15 second power. Yeah. But anyway, that's probably enough about that particular session. Let's see here. Can you give two pieces of advice for age group athletes on how they can improve their swimming?
Yeah. First, I think sort of ironic coming from a guy who loves the science, but just working on open water skills is huge. Sometimes I'll swim with people and I'll be swimming along and be like, what are you doing over there? Yeah, like we're swimming to this buoy over here. Yeah, it's amazing how I think, especially if you're coming from a place that's not coastal. I mean, people who grow up in California surfing typically are pretty good in the water. I'm thinking of one athlete in particular who's doing ITU. He grew up a surfer and just immediately was good at open water swimming. I think that's hugely valuable if you can grow up on the ocean. But yeah, practicing open water is a huge one for me. Being able to swim in a straight line, not panicking, understanding that sometimes you're going to swallow water and choke and it feels like you're dying, but just being able to remind yourself, I'm not dying, just keep on swimming. You know, like skills like that are hugely undervalued in my mind. And triathlon, especially as you get up to a high, like sort of a higher level, because the swim becomes more aggressive and you are more likely to get sort of punched in the head when you're lining up with 70 guys who are all similar ability levels compared to a time trial age group start, where it's easier to sort of find your own clear water. But yeah, practice open water skills. And then one more is in the pool, if you don't have open water, I think swimming with a band around your ankles is hugely valuable. I know swimming coaches have various opinions, you know, and are very adamant that their way is the right way. And some people might hate me for saying you should swim with a band around your ankle. And guess what? I have a watch on my wrist as I do this. So some people are going to hate that. But yeah, I think swimming with a band on your ankle or a band around your ankles is hugely valuable for open water, because what it does is teach you to have decent body position, which I think is more important than a perfect high elbow catch in open water. If you can have good body position, you can still pull some water and keep a high turnover. So I've found that super effective for swimming.
I think of the people the coaches that I know, that I know their opinion on the band question, I actually know a lot more that like the band than don't for triathlon. The watch is probably not the case. And cycling,
ride easy, like we were talking about. You can still get a huge benefit from riding easy and burning not much carbohydrate. Obviously it depends on how much time you have for training. If you only have 5 hours per week for riding, don't go do 5 hours with 7-1. That's not the most effective way to train. But don't be afraid to go out and ride easy. I think people have this mentality, like most of us do as endurance athletes, that you need to feel like you're working, trying to get a benefit from the workout. So I think it's probably been said 1,000 times, but yeah, don't be afraid to go easy on your easy sessions. There's still a lot of benefit from doing 4 hours of easy pedaling. And I've seen this with my athletes time and time again, and myself time and time again. If you can go out and do a 5 hour easy ride and come home and not be smashed and, you know, go about your day and not just be sitting on the couch the rest of the day, you're still getting a huge benefit from that workout.
And another one, if you have one?
Another one, work on your aerodynamics. It's huge. I mean, as a guy who doesn't put out much power, I've still ridden pretty fast off of 250 watts. Like, you can go very fast on a bike if you know how to go through the air and to handle your bike. So it sort of goes back to what we were saying about, you know, cultural not differences, but just where you grow up and how the influence it can have on your bike handling and bike power. But yeah, just learning how to ride a bike, both aerodynamically and skills wise, is massive, especially in pro races, where tactics are huge. In a straight up time trial, obviously aerodynamics is extremely important and skills become less important. But even on a flat course in an elite race with a 20 meter draft zone, tactics are huge. I mean, if you're letting a gap open up because you can't do enough power, but you get a few turns, you can immediately bring yourself back to the group simply by taking some simple turns better than everyone else in the group. So I think working on bike handling and just how the bike moves across land is hugely valuable, especially as you're moving up towards the elite level.
How would you distribute riding on the TT bike outdoors, riding on the road bike outdoors, and riding on the TT bike indoors, if those are kind of three main ways to get your riding done?
Yeah, I think if you're newer to, and I assume you're talking about non-draft since we're talking about TT bike. Yeah, if you're newer to the sport, spend a lot of time on a TT bike, and not just time, but hard efforts. There's something muscularly, just physically, you can't recreate in any other way besides going all out on a TT bike, I find. Just the discomfort you feel having to stay as aero as possible while going all out is only achieved one way, and that's by doing an all-out time trial. So if you're new to riding a TT bike, I would say like go all out sometimes, whether it's a five-minute test. You know, you can do it in testing or do some time trial races. Because there's only one way to get good at TTing, and that's to TT really hard in my mind. But if you've been doing it for 10 or 15 years, you can go on the gravel bike. And I suggest going on the gravel bike, not just the road bike, but I think riding off roads is awesome for your skills. If you can be a bad gravel rider compared to pro gravel riders, like, you're better than 95% of other triathletes on the bike then. So if you have 10 years on the TT bike, I think doing two hard workouts per week on the TT bike is good, especially if it's the same bike you've been riding for a while. And then go out on the gravel bike and enjoy it. Because if you've been at it for a long time, like, enjoyment becomes more important, I think, you know?
Yeah, that's the best I've ever ridden on a TT bike, like at least power-wise, was when I was doing a specific period of every week I was doing a race on Ruby in TT position. That was me specifically that chose to do that. Doing it. But between 30 minutes and usually the maximum was maybe 70, 75 minutes, and most of them would be 30 to 60 minutes. But every week, an all-out race, which wasn't just a pure time trial in the sense that it wasn't paced. It was obviously based on the terrain and the dynamics, but an all-out effort over a certain period with variable power, and I never had as good power as after that period. It was pretty hard though, so I kind of got away from it.
Yeah. My advice is to expect pain to anybody who's getting into TT riding. Yeah, like, you just need to embrace it. It's going to happen. Like, you're going to be super uncomfortable going all out on a TT bike.
And running. Two tips for running.
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and it's similar to cycling. I think doing running races is very good for running and triathlon. You see a lot of runners who are super fast on the track, and then it falls off quite a bit in triathlon, or not just on the track, but on the road, whatever. You know, their running ability fresh is a lot better than their running ability in a triathlon. And I think doing a lot of running races, one, it teaches you pacing, because when you find the limit and go over it, you know, there's only one way to find the limit, and that is to go over it, which I find is easy to do in running races. And there's something about just building durability. I know we were talking about volume being required for durability, but there's something about doing a lot of running races that I think does help your triathlon running. I honestly don't know what it is, but I grew up doing, you know, cross country and track and a lot of road races in the summer, and pretty quickly, my triathlon running was almost as good as my open running. And I think it had to do with a lot of running races. So that's one piece of advice, is hop in some 5Ks or 10Ks or even half marathons. Marathons are super taxing on your legs. So I wouldn't recommend, if you're focusing on triathlon, to do too many open marathons in the year. But doing some 5Ks, especially early on, I think is a good piece of advice for people who are newer to the sport. And it's fun, and it's a lot cheaper than a triathlon. So that's another benefit.
And do you have one more for running?
Yeah. Besides doing a lot of running races, I think doing workouts on hills is very good for triathlon, whether it's VO2 max intervals or threshold intervals. I would then use lactate if you're doing threshold intervals on an uphill. I wouldn't recommend doing all your threshold intervals on uphills, but for sure there is a strength aspect in uphill threshold running. That's very valuable for triathlon running. It's similar, I find, to being at altitude or being in heat. Any environmental constraint you can put on yourself I find tends to force economy. So if it's hot outside, at least personally, I feel I try to be more economical because now the environment is hurting me. If it, I'm at high altitude, I try to be more economical because your heart rate increases easier, you know, at the same paces. And hills are another example of that. And you don't have to, it doesn't have to be summer and you don't have to be at altitude to use a hill. So yeah, I think doing some faster running or harder running uphill is valuable for triathlon.
Yeah, good one. We're running low on time. I just want to get a couple of quick takes from you on aerodynamics then, because you already mentioned it. And also, you, like I mentioned, you have a small business doing aerodynamic products, basically. So, but just give a, like, you can decide what to talk about aerodynamics wise, but how can people go about improving their aerodynamics?
Yeah. So I think it's pretty easy. CDA, coefficient of drag times area. So you have two variables you're working with. One is frontal area. The nice thing about frontal area is you can see it just right in front of a mirror. And if you can see less of yourself, you've decreased your frontal area. So my general philosophy on aerodynamics is reduce area until it starts affecting your power noticeably. Once you've reached that point, now start working on how air is moving around your body. So getting smaller will probably make you faster. Elite time trialists are very low. You know, I know in triathlon, TT positions have come up and out quite a bit, especially over the last few years, which for sure, it opens your hips up. It makes running off the bike feel nicer and it probably improves power. And I tried that myself. I went from being in an extreme position, like perfectly flat back, to more elevated front end. And my power got 15 watts better pretty much immediately. I set my lifetime best power on 70.3, but I rode slower. I was being passed by guys who I usually pass on the bike. I was like, okay, actually, this sucks. You know, like aerodynamics is way more important for me than I thought. So yeah, reduce frontal area is step number one. And that's usually going lower or more narrow. So go until it's affecting your power and then train that position a little bit. Like it's going to be uncomfortable for sure at the beginning. If your elbows are very wide and you go to a more average position, it's going to be uncomfortable. But after four or five rides, it's going to become comfortable. So just try to reduce the area. Next is thinking about how air is moving around you. That's a little more complicated because you need to have like sort of an aero mind. And understand how air is flowing around your body, you know, and is it separating? Is there a huge, you know, chopped surface at the back, you know, like your arm, for example, like is the air just gonna, how is the wake behind your arm or your helmet or your body, whatever it is. But yeah, so that's essentially what I'm doing with the company is making products that once somebody has optimized their frontal area, now enhance how the air moves around their body, which I think if you look at an airplane, that's a good example of something that moves through the air efficiently. So if you can shape your body or your equipment like an airplane, you're probably moving in the right direction.
Yeah. And any quick thoughts, really quick thoughts on measuring your progress aerodynamics-wise, especially let's assume you don't have access to a wind tunnel or velodrome or things like that?
Yeah, I would say make your own velodrome outside. Golden Cheetah, it's not super advanced, but you do need to learn how to use the software. So Golden Cheetah is an awesome resource if people want to download that software. You need a speed sensor and a power meter and not too much wind. And with those things, you can get pretty accurate aerodynamic data. So if you're into the more involved side, I would use Golden Cheetah. If not, feel the air on your body. It's easy to do on a long downhill. So if you live somewhere where there's, you know, a 3-minute descent and you can stay in aero, just feel how the air changes around your body. If you stick your head up and now stick your head down and tuck it in as much as possible, you can notice the difference. Like if you're paying attention, especially if your jersey is slightly loose, you can feel, is your jersey flapping on your skin now or is it still? If it's still, there's no wind hitting it. If it's flapping, a lot of wind is hitting it. So stuff like that, you know, you can get very aero simply by noticing how the air is moving around your body, but you have to pay attention to that.
Yeah. Would you ever consider just like benchmark workouts that you ride to speed, or at least like measuring your speed against power? Or do you think that it's just a bit too difficult with too many variables when you ride outside that are hard to account for unless you really dive deep into it with Golden Cheetah?
Yeah, I think it's a little tough just to look at speed. For sure, look at it. Noticing speed, like putting, get a speed sensor. I would say first, don't use GPS. I would first recommend getting a speed sensor. You can get it on Amazon for $40. Use a speed sensor so you can see your speed. You can see in real time on a long straight stretch of road how position is changing your speed. Obviously, day to day, temperature changes, rolling resistance changes, you know, your kit changes. So if you're looking at speed changes day to day, you got to make sure everything is exactly the same. Like when I'm super into testing something, I'll weigh myself before every ride, make sure that PSI is exactly the same, same kit, same everything. Even then, it's tough to tell day-to-day changes. But I think simply by having a speedometer, like an accurate real-time speedometer, you can become way more aware of how your aerodynamics are. So even if you're not doing testing, I would recommend training with a speedometer, because you can get real-time, immediate feedback on your aerodynamics.
Yeah, no, that's a great tip. Yeah. Let's wrap it up there. I have a coaching call to get to.
Yeah.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. And just a quick reminder that if you're enjoying the show, then please leave a comment on Spotify or YouTube and tell me what you think. Tell me what you want to hear more about. I read every comment. And also vote in the poll on Spotify for how you like each episode, because that helps me know what sort of episodes are the listeners and everybody in the audience enjoys more and less, and it helps shape the direction of the show and the content. And as for today's episode with Robbie, you can find all of the links. A lot of the names we dropped in the beginning, I've interviewed them, so there will be a lot of related episodes there. And they will be on scientificdriveform.com/TTS707. And all the links to connect with Robbie as well, of course. And Robbie, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was great to have a chat with you.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. And I hope you're calm as well after this.